This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Pileater and director Richard Wollstonecraft. We're going to be discussing the new film Ghost in a Shell. Great talking to you guys.
Nice to talk to you, Robert.
Yes, good morning from Australia. You've got me up at 9 a.m. This is not my favorite time of day, but I'm all right.
So Ghost in a Shell, originally it was a manga back in the 80s, and then there was an animated film in Japan in the 90s, and this is a kind of a live, well, the first live-action film that just came out.
I just watched the first half hour of the 1995 Ghost in a Shell film, just to do a bit of research, because people were kind of accusing the new film of various things, and I just wanted to add some context, just because I was not familiar. There's been a few of these films. There's been about five, actually, I think, or at least three or four of them, and I mean the animated anime ones. And I just thought I'd watch the first half hour, and it doesn't seem like this film is doing anything out of the ordinary or really changing things that much or toning things down or, it seems like it's just they've actually done a pretty good job at adapting this comic from what I can see. The film seems to be far more sophisticated than the 1995 film.
Yes.
That's thing, but
I have to agree with you there. Mm-hmm.
Part of it is the context of the audience. Depending if you're a big anime fan, for people who are hardcore anime fans, obviously they're going to prefer the anime. But for
here's the thing about the anime Ghost in the Shell, the 95. It really comes in the tradition of that pulpy 15-ing Japanimation animes where you had really bad English dubs of Akira, Cyber City Yoda 808, and Ghost in the Shell. You know, Wikipedia will go and say it's one of the greatest anime films of all time, but when you put it in its, like, classic 1995 environment, there pretty much was just, like, pulpy and bloody, and just, like, I swear, there's, like in the original one, Batuu is like, you fucking dickhead, just saying names, out of nowhere, and it feels like, it comes from the tradition, like, manga entertainment. You're supposed to watch this while, like, jamming out to, like, KMFDM and Atari Teenage Riot and silly stuff like that,
I mean, there's a weird, obviously there's some kind of connection to anime and the alt-right. And to be honest, that actually slightly eludes me because I've never been a fan of anime. I'm not a fan of animated films full stop. And that includes shows like South Park. And I mean, obviously I have watched them. And obviously the greats of the genre like Akira I've seen. And I really like that, for example. But I've never been a fan of all this anime stuff. And so it's something a little bit new to me, but obviously I can see why people might like it. I mean, it's a bit kind of geeky, I think, anime, but it's still, I like that it's from Japan, and I've been to Japan about 5 or 6 times, and there's just something, wonderful about, like, Tokyo culture and the way they've embraced Western ideas and then just, done a whole Japanese Tokyo thing on it, and it's just, I don't know, it's out of this world and crazy, and I love all that, and this kind of peak of technology that they put into a lot of their stuff is amazing, and et cetera. So I do sort of get it in a way, but I'm not someone of the alt-right who's like one of these mad anime fans. So
there's anime right, guys.
Oh, like, yeah, anime right. No, anime right, they
don't like me either.
They
don't like me. I've written articles for Anime Right. They think I'm some kind of weird civic nationalist race mixer, and that's totally not true. I'm just saying, look, how can you be a Nazi if you like anime and Asian culture? Like, you just want, like, some of that piece of the pie. It's like, make up your mind. You can't have your cake and eat it, too. I wrote an article about that, saying, like, getting the alt Anime Right out of the alt-right bag, saying, are you a part of the alt-right, or are you doing this thing where you take the traditions of the alt-right and you're saying that you're some master race based upon anime and it assumes questions within Asian Aryanism? And they got mad at me for that. I mean, there's just basically Daily Stormers or Nazis that like anime.
Well, Pileater, didn't you say in your hypothetical Asian Aryanism there could be, like, one section just for weebs, so it would be,
exactly,
like, simply white people into Japanese culture? But they wouldn't be forced to sleep with Asian women.
No, not at all. They would just be dedicated.
They can have, like, their blonde white girlfriends dress up like anime characters and have, like, white kids.
You could.
I'd say most men on the alt-right would have no problem with being forced to sleep with Japanese women.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Exactly. I mean, but back on the whole anime thing.
Women are beautiful, man. Like, I've always been a fan of Asian culture, and one of the things I like about Asian people in general, whether it be Japanese, people in Hong Kong, people in Singapore, these are all cities I've visited many times, is they're very conservative. They're very conservative. They're very naturally right-wing. They're very xenophobic. I hate all outsiders. I will tolerate basically white expats, like, you know, like a very small amount in this city, maybe under 5%. They can tolerate that. And if it gets any more than that, they get sick to death of it. So, I mean, I think there's nothing... there's nothing wrong with applying the ideas of the alt-right as a kind of universalism, that any race can sort of take on alt-right ideas, and that other races that seem to have that natural tendency, which Asians do in general, I think, you know, we have no problem there at all. And that not only that, it's a kind of kismet between the races and societies, and I think there's a lot we can learn. In relation to, for example, Japan and immigration, they don't allow any immigration at all, outside of a limited expat community and a limited... you know, there's some Chinese people there who are labourers and stuff, you know, but it's all under 10%. The whole place, I've been to Japan, as I said, about six times. It's extremely Japanese. And, you know, I mean, Colin Liddell, for example, lives there. He's one of the big, you know, alt-right figures, and, you know, he fits into that culture very well. So, you know, I think it's there's no – and obviously, you know, they fought on the right side during World War II. And, you know, so it's all good, basically.
Film, it is the original one takes place in Japan. The new film, it doesn't specifically say what country it takes place in, but it's filmed in Hong Kong. But the culture is a lot of Japanese imagery and cultural references. But yeah, it is a superb aesthetic. Richard, you've been to Hong Kong.
I have.
How well do they capture Hong Kong in the film?
Yeah, I've been to Hong Kong two or three times, but I think first of all we should probably, you know, let's talk about why this film is kind of controversial and raises kind of issues in relation to the alt-right, because, you know, it's been accused of, you know, I mean, obviously in the alt-right, well, you know, we might look at a film like a new Star Wars film and go, oh, it's so multicultural, it's, you know, like in episode 7 there was like one of the leads was a black guy, and I know a lot of people in the alt-right were kind of whinging about that, and this is like the reverse. This is like where a lot of the main characters...
Oh, yeah, like the original film, you're basically taking like an Asian film, yes. But then the lead role is played by this white actress.
Well, the top five leads in the film have been Aryanized or have been turned into Europeans. There's Juliette Binoche, who plays like a kind of scientist who helps create this hybrid of human being and robot, and then... there's like a sort of a guy within this company. I don't know the actor's name, but he's like a head villain. And then there's like a big guy who looks like Rand Xerox. He's also a kind of...
it looks like Guy Fieri and Ricky from Trailer Park Boys. But so...
There you go. But also, it should also be said that while about five of the male leads have been turned into Europeans, there's a lot of leads in the film that are also Asian, like Takeshi Takano, the Japanese actor who is a legend. He also plays one of the leads, and there are a number of other supporting roles played by Asian actors. So it's really a half-half, and I think in relation to Hollywood, this is kind of actually probably the way it should have been done, and if it wasn't for political correctness, I don't think anyone would have complained about it. I just wanted to put that out there just to begin with, because I think that sort of brackets, I think, you know, a way that the alt-right could talk about the film, and that we should be defending it, because I think there's nothing wrong with what this film's done, and that it should be supported, and it's being called a flop, but I think it's one of the best things that's come out of Hollywood in the past, April, 4 months? So, you know, I mean, I think it could be a sleeper hit if people continue to go see it, and I highly recommend it to all, because I think it's, you know, without a doubt, one of the top films that's actually come out of the Hollywood system in the last four months.
I love the soundtrack in the film. I really love their the use of some of the new synthesizer stuff in that. You know, there's kind of these weird... I was looking up the soundtrack for bits and songs of it. It really is this new... You know, the old Terminator film had like an obviously cheesy synthesizer soundtrack with like from the 80s or whatever. And now you have this new synthesizers, which is kind of, you know, up to date on that technology and the whole... vaporwave aesthetic, you know, you see that.
Yeah, it's more, maybe not vaporwave, but it's definitely cyberpunk, like it has that strong 80s retro-futurist aesthetic to it.
It's Clint Mansell, isn't it, who did the soundtrack? I think that's correct.
There are some multiple people.
He's done a number of interesting soundtracks, and I get him confused with Clint is it Cliff Martinez? Or there's two of them that one's worked with Nicholas Winding Refn and one's done a lot of other major Hollywood films. I get them confused, but they're both actually quite good. But no, I agree. The soundtrack I thought in this was excellent. I may even be worth hunting down. You know?
Yeah, I was looking for it, but it's just bits and parts of the songs of it. And you just gotta listen to it online. It's something I would like to have on like vinyl or something. I find it very atmospheric, the soundtrack in it. When I saw the film, I got the impression that it seemed to be just a couple. It seems like they got the movie and some of the animes and detected the best slices of it and tried to fit the story in 2.5 hours. And just went through there, and it seemed like a mediocre superhero film. They left a cliffhanger to say, well, look out for Ghost in the Shell 2. And so they did a good job on the whole cosplaying or the authentic nostalgic dining. And it seems to me in that tradition of Star Wars, The Force Awakens, where they're just playing on your nostalgia feelings, where you want to relive the Ghost in the Shell experience or something, or at least that people, normies, are so forgetful they need to have a new vitamin to show them that this was the past, or at least rewrite history again with this Ghost in the Shell movie. That's how I thought of it as. But I pretty much thought it was a mediocre film with a actually concocted liberal message. I thought there was a lot of emphasis on this whole social construction theory about being a quote-unquote, you know, brain in the vat or ghost in the shell. And then,
but you could interpret it different ways. You could interpret it as this kind of liberal message that we're all the same.
Exactly.
Or you could just kind of interpret it from an identitarian perspective that we're headed in this kind of atomized world. We're all, in a sense, ghosts in a shell, in a sense that we're these kind of, like, atomized beings that lack any kind of identity. So it could be interpreted either way.
I didn't see that at all. Obviously, I'm coming new to it, so it should be right. I'm not a fan. I mean, I'd never seen the original Ghost in the Shell until, like, this morning when I watched half an hour of it just before this podcast. So I came new to it. I can understand there is a sort of message there, but I think the film has a lot of interesting messages in relation to the mind-body theory that actually comes from Western political philosophy and a philosopher like Gilbert Ryle, who wrote On the Ghost and the Machine, which is a kind of theory that comes from the philosophy of mind and is actually quite a complex idea from Western philosophy. So I didn't think, you know, that I can understand there is a liberal message possibly there, but you know, it's got to be remembered, a lot of this Japanese stuff, a lot of this Japanese animation, even Akira and stuff, I mean, and particularly this film, I mean, it's basically a death squad. It's kind of a fascist death squad.
There's some hidden Shinto values within the text that the West doesn't want to...
is a member of a death squad, a fascist death squad, what's it called? Division 9. And these are basically like a fascist police squad that go around bumping people off for the government. And I don't really see that as particularly liberal. The whole overarching story of the film, to me, has a kind of more fascist vibe. And also there's the constant kind of fetishization of weapons, fetishization of tanks, fetishization of kind of fascist armory and stuff that I think really overwhelms any slight liberal message that Hollywood may have been able to kind of slip in there that I think is far more powerful. So to me,
when you look at it that way, it certainly can. But the ideal where you have the white waspian bad guy running the evil corporation and, you know, her previous life as a Japanese protester protecting a Shinto shrine, kind of like a Vondervogel thing. But,
obviously the fact that the main villain is actually, we probably shouldn't say this, we'll say spoilers, but the main villain turns out to be a guy within the actual kind of robotics corporation that is behind creating the Scarlett Johansson kind of Ghost in the Shell character. And
I'll just be a spoiler anyway. Who you think is the villain ends up being the first person who was experimented on for this project, and then the experiment went wrong, and then
You can't get much more Aryan than Michael Pitt. I mean, he's about as white as Hollywood actors come, and he plays like, I guess, what's supposed to be the main villain, but he turns out to actually be a good guy, and I thought it was actually a really excellent performance from Pitt, and he was quite sympathetic because he's quite a killer in the beginning, and you know, you sort of come around to his point of view a bit, like, and you see how he's been wronged. that he was experimented upon, and that both of them were abducted from like this kind of artist commune that's almost like an alt-right commune within, say, Japan or within, say, Hong Kong. And this happens when I was in Hong Kong, there were a number of dissidents who were arrested when I was there for critiquing the Chinese government. And they were arrested, and then they obviously were killed and experimented upon and made into these ghosts in the shell. The Michael Pitt character, his experiment sort of failed. And so he became this kind of – he obviously escaped and became this dissident rebel and terrorist. And then obviously the Scarlett Johansson character was the one that I think is the weapon that they – and, of course, that's the other thing. She's meant to be a weapon, and that's the main villain of the film calls her that. This is all fascist. You know, it's basically two forms of fascism fighting each other, which is exactly what's going on in the world at the moment. Everybody is now a fascist. There's no other form of politics on the planet than fascism, and that's what we're dealing with.
Yeah, just different groups like fighting for power.
Exactly. Different will to power, different ways of expressing it. I mean, the globalists that we all criticize, they're basically fascists. They're just the kind of fascism that we on the alt-right don't like, and probably for damn good reason.
What do you think about the whole theme of transhumanism and cybernetics? When the original Ghost in the Shell came out, I mean, that was quite some time ago. But now transhumanism and cybernetics are being discussed, I mean, not just as a science fiction issue, but a science fiction issue, but as actually an issue, a serious, something that will be implemented and probably sometime in the, possibly the near future.
What do you think, Pilita? Let's hear your opinion first, and I'll panel off
of mine. You know, it's weird because I find transhumanism as a strange kind of... if not corrected, it could be this weird liberal way where the black lesbian wants to be something else, right? Or you're based upon your identity. The whole concept of designer babies, it's a very capitalist-minded thing, you know, a materialistic thing. And it's quite scary to think about. And through Ghost of the Shell, if, you know, I'm looking at the liberal message here, the like how the normie, the cultural Marxist normie would look at this, you know, he'll say, well, we're all just brains and machines, and it really doesn't matter, because I could do this without any integral or biological background, and it becomes this really silly thing about consciousness and about loving things that are there was this philosopher, I think his name is John R. Seale. He had the strong, the Chinese room, or the computer AI theory, where he believed that the Chinese room was the artificial AI could never be like a human. There's some limits to it. And that was kind of fighted with Derrida, and they often talked about that. I'm looking his name up, John R. Searle, I think it was. I'm not that well known on the theory, but it's an interesting ideal of how far artificial intelligence can go. But for the part of transhumanism... for the right-wing interpretation, I mean, there are things where, you know, you could progress and become, like, space marines, like in Warhammer 40K, or go into the stars and go on different planets and not breathe in oxygen and become pretty much this science fiction creature that can conquer the world. But there is this warning between this weird, liberal, concocted, materialistic world while just doing nothing and having... Like in the film, in the Ghost in the Shell film, when she's walking the streets, you know, seeing everyone has an avatar above their head, you know, everyone's plugged into different virtual realities because everything outside is so disgusting. Or even looking that odd part with that black hooker, right? And she wants to buy her, and she like touches her for to know what she wants to be human, right? They use the black person as the human thing, which I find kind of strange.
Oh, so she's like, yeah, one of the few last, the hooker is like the last human left. Like, they're all being,
exactly.
Placed by artificial intelligence.
And she's real, and happens to be an African, a black person, you know?
Oh, well, I think you're overreacting now. I mean, she's the only black person in the whole film. So, you know, I think, you know, I mean, you know, I don't think, I mean, and there are a lot of black hookers in Hong Kong and in Japan, so, I mean, you know.
Yeah, that is true if you think about dark skin, but, I mean, yeah, go ahead.
I think this liberal idea of, you know, us all being atomized is actually, when one follows it through, when one follows it from the ideas of materialist science, actually is a worse form of fascism than ones
being proposed by the alt-right and even traditionalist kind of movements, and even, I guess, the kind of communist kind of authoritarianism that's being proposed in far-left utopian dreams. Look, there's a philosopher by the name of Hubert Dreyfus who argued that AI will never actually get off the ground, because he actually uses the theories of Martin Heidegger, who's one of my philosophical heroes and guiding lights or whatever, to say that computers will always not have what Heidegger calls kind of being there, a kind of element, and a kind of being towards death, and a kind of basically it's the element of consciousness of one's own existence. And that we can, computers will always be able to imitate things that human beings do in relation to, like certain abilities and even certain mathematical skills. But it will never actually have its own consciousness. In the sense, it will never fear for its own consciousness. It will never have the worries that human beings have about the finitude of our own existence. And, he's written a whole series of books, Herbert Dreyfus, where he kind of expands upon the ideas of Martin Heidegger in this way. So I think, and obviously Heidegger was a fascist and a Nazi, and his ideas are kind of connected to this kind of rooted, almost like rural kind of world that Heidegger lived in outside of Freiburg and in the mountains of Tautnauburg around Freiburg University and in the southern Germany. So I think it's interesting, and I think that the film is a kind of warning, I think, about that. Though it seems that, obviously, it's revealed that there have been 98 experiments on human beings before they got to the Scarlett Johansson character. So obviously there's been a lot of horror. And that Juliette Binoche, who's one of the scientists, even though she's portrayed as a sympathetic character who is sympathetic in the film, and obviously Juliette Binoche is a beautiful French actress. It's questionable. This liberal worldview of this being atomized, I think, is actually being...
She, like, lets him go, and the part... That makes me feel like Born Free,
Exactly. I think it's... And part of the genius of the film is that it raises these ideas and allows the audience to kind of question them. And I think all good art does that. And that's why I was a big fan of the film. And as I said, I am new to it. I am new to this kind of phenomena of Ghost in the Shell. And, as I said, I've only seen half an hour of the anime from 1985. I've never read the comics in my life, but anyway, I found it interesting and refreshing, and I think other people who are maybe new to this world might find it that way also.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you were saying about this liberal Adam. I don't want to say liberal fascism because I don't want to sound like Jonah Goldberg, but this kind of you could say fascist identitarianism. You could say that's brutal, but it gives people an identity, this kind of liberal atomization that the film does touch upon, definitely. I mean, even like leftists like Chomsky have had that quote where he said, like, liberal capitalism, he said it just destroys any personal identity. Basically, everyone is just this kind of a cog that is disposable.
No, I think, and I mean, it's no secret now that a lot of the kind of more authoritarian and even slightly fascist things that are coming from our culture. I mean, people who are having their speech shut down, this is all coming from, like, what's the contemporary culture Marxist left. I mean, most alt-righters are very much pro-free speech, even if it's the kind of speech we don't like. We're like, oh, well, whatever, you know what I mean, we're happy to listen to you. So, like, it seems to be almost, I guess the cuck side of the left and the cuck side of the right. They seem to be the most censorious. They are the ones that want to shut things down. They are the ones that want to control things. They're the ones who want to start the wars in Syria. These are the ones who are the most fascist. And, of course, the alt-right and the far-right, we're coming across as... I mean, obviously, we have a slightly dangerous dimension. I'll happily admit that. But, we're coming across almost, as a kind of counterculture at the moment, as someone like Paul Joseph Watson has pointed out. And I don't think we should fear, as I said, like when we had David Thrussell on your show, people who are kind of a radical left Marxists, because they have a lot of interesting ideas. Now, I see a real connection between the traditional, old school, left Marxism and the new alt-right and against the globalist 1%. I think that's a really interesting, what's it called? I don't know what you call it, possible alliance. And so, and that it is this kind of way of looking at the world of liberalism, of atomization, of using science you know, a materialist science to justify everything. Obviously, I have an interest in science and I have an interest in the philosophy of science. But I find it, you know, the way that it is manipulating everything is hideous. The way it's turning everything into a unit or an element of profit. And this is something that is dealt with in Ghost in the Shell. The question of dehumanization through technology is obviously the major issue of it. And that, you know, and this idea from Gilbert Ryle that the mind is a kind of ghost that haunts the kind of flesh machine that you occupy. And that possibly this ghost, if you were to move your brain into a machine, and obviously trans, you know, humanists and futurists, like, what's the name of that guy? I can't remember his name. No, he did a show called Trans something or other. He's a Jewish guy, Kurzweil. You know, he believes in the singularity. He's wrote a book about the singularity. Anyway, he believes we're going to be able to download our consciousness into computers around the year 2040 or whatever. This may well be true, but, like, I don't know. Would we still be human if we were all made up of machines? Obviously, a recent episode.
That's interesting because in the film, like, they have complete power. Like, they can download our consciousness, they can delete it, they can upload new stuff. But despite all that, she still has a kind of will by the end of the film to discover her true identity and overcome that.
No, absolutely, and the way that this technology is essentially used, you know, by the main villain of the film, not the Michael Pitt character, the other bloke, his name I can't remember. You know, it's all weaponized. It's all to do with like almost liberal fascism or like, you know, like capitalist fascism. You know, the way this can all be, how can be instrumentalized in future weapons. And in the sense that when she rebels and even when Michael Pitt's character rebels, you know, this is a kind of alt-right rebellion, discovering one's roots and, you know, returning, you know, at least to some element of humanity. And I think that for all its criticism, I think the alt-right does value humanity in the sense that it values, you know, local identities. It values one's national identity. It values one's ethnic identity. And I think that's important, and that should be important to all peoples of, and all races on this planet, and not just be something that's you know, a pro-white thing. I think this is a universalized idea, really.
Yeah, and that theme is also touched upon in the film, because as I said, it's very vague where it takes place, because obviously it's an Asian society, but I remember where they're talking to these Africans, and they're talking about like an African federation.
Yeah.
And they're kind of like implying that we're living in this world where we have this like a one-world society without any borders.
Absolutely. It's definitely a kind of globalist nightmare. That's the kind of world that is portrayed. And obviously, you know, we are definitely heading that way. And you can see at the moment with Donald Trump, the way he's being sidelined and, that, you know, he maybe is going to be kind of fooled into acting on Syria with this recent globalist gas attack in Syria, which I think is, you know, they used this trick once before, and I don't even think Obama went for it. And to send in land troops into Syria. So, you know, it's just, it's all very strange. But that's definitely the nightmare we're all living at the moment. And, you know, it's definitely omnipresent.
I thought it was an interesting concept in the film that it wasn't really about the Major herself, but about her previous life and how she realized that she wasn't this Major. Originally, she was this Japanese teenager who left her family to go with these other vagabond Japanese cyberpunks and protect this shrine, whether it's a Luddite hippie party, and the big bad evil corporation was going to mow it down. They took her life and they put her in this. And now I thought that was funny because that really was the theme of the whole. And it's like this angst emo where it's like, oh, I want my original life back. But then she's, I guess, this Martin Heidegger thing where she's like, oh, well, this is my new destiny. I'm going to serve justice. The way of, but there's this interesting fascination I found interesting with this Japanese anarchist, the same style that maybe Atari Teenage Riot would flirt with on their 60-second Wipeout album. There seems to be this really abstract Japanese teenager anarchist hobbyist that sounds very sweeple stuff, white plate people like-minded, and yet
you have that culture in Japan is kind of a backlash to the culture of kind of conformity, where students were expected to work hard, obey authority, become like a good worker. And I think it really came out of like Japan in the 90s, where you did have these like youth movements that were.
Yeah, but in the American, you know, one of the biggest things about the film is say it's whitewashed, right? They argue that the film is whitewashed, and yet at the same time, that argument could be for a right-wing argument or could be for a because it's like they tried to satisfy your sweeple desires by saying, look at those, you know, you never really hear of cyberpunk Japanese anarchists, right? It's a figment of a white man's imagination, you know? And so what happens is, you know, they show it and put it on screen, and then these other white people are like, that's whitewashing, it's inauthentic. And it's like, what do you really want? Do you want, like, ethno-nationalism or a figment of our imagination?
What is interesting in the film is that originally she was an Asian. I mean, she was an Asian student. And she revisits her mother, who is an Asian woman. So obviously her brain is Asian, and that she's been put into a kind of robot body that is European. So, and also, too, I mean, these, you know, this kind of thing, they're at the shrine, whether it be a Shinto shrine or something along those lines, or a Buddhist shrine. You know, I mean, this can have two interpretations. It can have a liberal one, or it can have a kind of more traditionalist kind of alt-right kind of interpretation. I mean, you know, there are rebels. I mean, I think, you know, all of us at the moment are kind of rebels against the system to a certain extent, and we're critiquing it, and that maybe in the future we'll be looked upon as kind of slightly anarchist in our views and stuff. So, I mean, I don't know. I didn't necessarily find that part of it that objectionable. And obviously, it was shot in Hong Kong, and I've been there, and it was a beautiful backdrop. It definitely.
Well, yeah, the aesthetics of the film were superb. It has a very kind of a cyberpunk, like 80s retro futuristic feel to it. I mean, you were saying you've been to Hong Kong. How well do they capture the feeling of the city?
I think they captured it very well. I mean, one of the things I actually shot parts of the Second Coming Volume 2 there. Because I was just instantly hit by how kind of amazing it was as a backdrop to a film. So I actually had a small sequence there for the Second Coming Volume 2, which is going to be finished in the next 6 weeks or so. But then what happened was I also, you know, because I'm somebody who always hunts down interesting bookshops, you know, and I visited a number of, I guess what they would be called, radical kind of bookshops. And they were generally left radical. So, you know, you can pick up the odd interesting book on Gramsci or something. Sometimes I'd find a book on Carl Schmitt or something like this, you know, a fascist intellectual. So, you know, I visited all these shops. And then about 3 months after I left Hong Kong, I heard that all these shops were closed down. They're in a particular building on a couple of series of buildings. And that just about everybody, you know, who was connected with them was arrested. And it was like fucking, you know, they came down on these because they were basically critiquing Chinese influence in Hong Kong, which was always seemed as obviously slightly separate, and obviously it was under English protection for 100 years, and now it's been handed back to China, who obviously slowly and insidiously kind of, I mean, I'm not even sure you would call the Chinese government anymore, but I don't know what they are now. There's some kind of capitalism with authoritarian ideas, really, is now becoming more and more, it's kind of, hegemony is becoming more and more dominant over Hong Kong. And obviously these radicals were not to be tolerated by the current Chinese government, so they were rounded up. So I think that bears relevance to the story of this film. You know, for example, I don't know what happened to these dissidents. Maybe they were whisked off to some medical place and their brains were removed and they're now building them into cyber robots. You know?
Yeah.
But that would be the story of the film.
Hilliard, do you want to comment on the aesthetics of the film? It does. I mean, it definitely has a lot of similarities to Akira. There's even similarities to the kind of Blade Runner aesthetic.
Yeah, I was about to mention that. You know, it's Ghost in a Shell came from that 90s tradition where, starting in 1984, you had William Gibson's Neuromancer, which was pretty much his invention of his own cyberpunk universe. It's pretty much trademarked under his name. And yet, at the same time, there's these cliches, starting with Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, that the cyberpunk aesthetic takes place in some cucked world where Japan or China rules over everyone and everyone's dirty in a terrible dystopian multicultural society, and yet there's this fascination with the Japanese. And so what happened is you've seen a lot of these animes or mangas in the 80s and 90s that were basically emulating off that because that's what everyone else in America liked. And then these shows appeared and the definition of anime became this strange Ghost in the Shell, Akira, Cyber City Oda 808, whatever, and basically...
Well, Pillator, there was the 80s manga of Ghost in the Shell before the 90s animated film.
Exactly, and the 90s was...
How would you compare the aesthetic of the 80s one to the 90s film?
If you even look at Appleseed, it's the same one also by, I think his name is Shiro. You know, it's this cheesy kind of... I mean, he does erotic art. You know, he's not that. Here's the thing: a lot of liberals like to think everybody's kind of universal and whatever, but there's this intellectual rift of why most people don't like anime or manga, because it's a form of chinkery, meaning that it's a very not to say inferior, but it's this ideal that Asians just emulate, that Chinese just take and they put in their free market system, and they really don't have anything deep to say, right? The word Ghost in the Shell seems to be just a taken word from another book, I think Ghost in a Machine by another book, and it just seems to be taken that context. Then we as Westerners try to pry it open and see that there's bigger meanings than that, when we're really supposed to focus on the Asian aesthetic part. And so when
there is, yeah, I get what you're saying, and there's a lot of truth to that. But I mean, even if you look at a film like Blade Runner, which came out several years before Kira, I mean, that film was, I think it was filmed in either Tokyo or Hong Kong.
Now, Blade Runner is original, but if you think of Ghost in the Shell, this adaption, it's really strange to think of it as being meta, that it's based on an anime that's based on Blade Runner, which is based on Williams Gibson, which is, you know, it becomes this strange convoluted layers, and really just reintroduces the whole silly cyberpunk genre of there's evil corporations, there's anime Japanese-like aesthetic people. They are, and they just follow this guideline. And that's another criticism I had about Ghost in the Shell, is they're really trying to sell the 90s anime cyberpunk 15-ing definition again.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I think, you know, there's a famous book by Arthur Koestler, Ghost in the Machine. Obviously, I think probably the title was probably originally inspired by that. But one of the things that Japanese culture does, and that, you know, I would not argue that it is not original. It certainly uses a lot of influences, but in the same way that someone like Quentin Tarantino does. You know, when you watch Tarantino's work, if you have a large knowledge of cinema, you can see sometimes even whole sequences taken from different films or even elements of soundtrack from famous films. But then he combines it in such an original way that it actually does become an original work. So I think that Japanese culture does that as well. You know, sure, it's, you know, riffing on this and that, but I mean, it's almost, you know, you could even bring in a kind of French post-structuralist thinker like Jean Baudrillard as a kind of example of what the Japanese are doing. You know, I mean, you know, it becomes the simulacra of the simulacra, and you know, I mean, the copy has been copied so many times that it's become original. You know what I mean? Or at least original in the Baudrillardian universe, in the sense that it's certainly become something different or unique, or it's mutated into something.
Because the original Ghost in Shell was just a manga, a pulp manga, and that was it. And even the movie, into some respect. But it was the West that really made it into its own wholly put it on a pedestal thing. You know, it's very interesting.
One thing I think, you know, the alt-right, and we should be more proud of our own European and Western cultures, is that in a sense we still are the dominant kind of culture on this planet. And, you know, even though we are multicultural to a certain extent in most of our societies, you know, we are like the Borg. You know, sure, there are elements, you know, like radical Islamic terrorists and radical Islamic communities that remain. But we are like the Borg. So many people that come to Western cultures become us. They don't become themselves. They totally become us. I mean, whether they're black, white or Asian or whatever. And I mean, for example, a classic example here in Australia is a guy called Waled Ali. He's a Muslim, but he's been put on television. And the more he remains on Australian television, the more he becomes like an actual Australian, because he won some awards. And you can see him almost like self-justifying losing his kind of Muslim identity and becoming more like an Aussie bloke. And the more I watch him, because I hate the guy, I can't stand him, but the more I do occasionally see him, he's becoming us. We're like the Borg, you know what I mean? Like, we really are turning these other races into Western white people, whether they're whatever, you know. So I think that's one thing the alt-right almost lacks, a sense of confidence that we have a certain kind of Borg ability to transform people into us, and that I don't think we should be quite so paranoid. I mean, obviously, I detest immigration, and I'm all for limiting the fuck out of it, but, like, we, you know, the amount of people that do come here to our country that we turn into us is extraordinary. And I think we should be more confident of our ability to, you know, affect, and you know, that we are the ones who are still taking over, and that we're not going to live in some Asian post fucking bullshit. No, everyone's going to be European, and Asians particularly love being European. They love it, and I think they would like the way a lot of the main characters in this film are European. Asians will love this. They like to lose the fact that they've got slanty eyes. They're always kind of like doing things. No, I mean, I'm serious. I mean, you go to their countries in Thailand, there are many operations they have to make their skin look whiter and less yellow. They want to be us. Everyone wants to be us. And you know why? Well, we know why. Because we're the best. You know, that's all there is.
Yeah, it's true. But first, I wanted to mention that, you know, it's interesting that, you know, if a white guy goes and says, well, I'm an Asian studies major, most of the continental philosophers or people who majored in English or whatever are going to look weird at you because they obviously know, oh, what's the Asians had done? They're just weird Buddhists and Shinto and weird. And it's like, it seems like everything they bring is just convoluted. Because it seems like if you really look at Asian culture, you know, you could say there's Confucius and Lao Tzu, but there's also like Yukio Mishima and Haruki Murakami and, you know, yes, all these great Japanese literature. It's weird because most of it we learned through translation. And I do believe there is a concrete high art Asian culture. It's just not well known in the West, and because of this ideal of chinkery basically makes people look down upon it. Now, going back on Robert, what he was saying about the Asian-Aryan aesthetic within the film, you're kind of right. And also Israeli-Aryan because it's Scarlett Johansson. And that's funny because it's like, that's so confusing. If she's an Asian girl inside a Israeli Aryan body, does that make her is Asian Israeli Aryan? You know, not to get multi-culti or the Kalergi plan in effect, but
I know her brother, and I've hung out with her brother in Bali. He lives there, Ian Johansson, and you know, the family's extremely Scandinavian. I think the mother, Ian Johansson and Skull have different mothers because they come from two different wives of the father, who the father is very Aryan and, you know, like Scandinavian, etc. But I think Skull has a Jewish mother. I'm not exactly sure. But, you know, the family is very European, very stilted in that. So I think, you know, saying she's Israeli, I think is bullshit, mate. Her roots lie more in Scandinavia and obviously America, where she now lives. I mean, obviously, she has a slight Jewish connection that makes Woody Allen cast her in films, but you know, she's the she's an Aryan princess. I wouldn't worry about that, mate.
But I think it's more interesting on the fact that it definitely flirts. There has been flirts, this flirtation with Asian Aryanism in the past, and it seems to me that yes, Asians do want to be white, and yet there is this strange group of whites that are like Asian society and want to incorporate in it. It seems to be a bond between whites and Asians. Now, it seems, yeah, obviously whites are going to have the ruling power over that because, yeah, Western civilization is great. And I think there could be a faction where whites can still be pure on that side and Asians can be pure on that side, but there's going to be this weird bridge culture where you have a bunch of weird Eurasians or, you know, whitewashed Asians or Asians wanting to be Asians or Eurasians or, you know, whatever. They're just going to congregate together and make their own little Asian Aryan institution. And possibly films like Ghost in the Shell love, or at least think about that future.
You know, I mean, look, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's all very, I mean, obviously there are different ways to kind of categorize it, little subsets of kind of alt-right kind of groups that might have an interest in this kind of thing. But I mean, you know, I mean, to be white, I've always been an equal opportunity employee when it comes to having sex with people. I've had sex with all races, but I would only marry somebody who is of probably Australian and European. You know what I mean? That's just
exactly. It's the shoe allegory. You would rather prefer to fit in someone's your own shoes. It makes sense.
Yeah, I've had two or three main girlfriends for you know, over the course of my life, and they've always been of that ethnicity and ethnic background. But like, I've been to Asia and slept with Asian girls, and that's fantastic. And I highly recommend it to all people of the opposite. Yeah, you know,
they should. I'm tired of that. I'm sick and tired of like they hate Asian girls. It's like, come on, dude, you fucking love Asian girls sucking your dick. I know.
Right? Asian women are gorgeous, man. They're gorgeous, and they are the least. I won't go into the details, but they're very nice.
It would be okay to get one pregnant and have the kids. I'm okay with that too, and I would say Asian Aryanism is a safe space for that, and it's not degenerate.
If you want to do it, go ahead. Exactly. I mean, I would say within the alt-right that we should probably stick to our own, but if there's the odd person that does something different, good luck to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly, and that's what I'm doing with my project. Now, on Robert's side, I guess Robert comes from this weird Jewish background where he believes that there's a lot of conspiratorial interest that these Jewish girls want to be white. And so when they want to be white, I guess that what Robert claims them is Israeli Aryan because they are a little ashamed being Jewish. But they have to make their own institution for that, which I think Robert Stark is going to write in his novel.
Jewish girls are fucking fantastic. I mean, I've had a couple of Jewish lovers in the 90s, one of whom helped me start the Hellfire Club. I got the whole idea from starting the Hellfire Club from this Jewish girl in Venice Beach who I had an affair with in the early 90s.
Robert take notes.
As kinky as fuck in everything, introduced me to S&M clubs and like was just the wildest, kinkiest girl. I think one of the wildest, kinkiest girls I've ever dated. And She was fantastic. And every time I come to LA, she will always hook me up with Hollywood people and we'll have dinner. And she's so loyal and friendly and really nice. Lives in Venice Beach. She's got a husband now. And of course, I get along with him. And, you know, he knows I fucked her in the 90s, blah, blah, blah. But that was before he was dating her. So who cares?
You know, I had a really two kinky Asian girlfriends and they were like really into S&M. And at first I was like intimidated by it. And I was like, I don't know if this is right for me. And it's like the first time it was painful. Then it's like now there's this weird scar where it's like, you know, I kind of do like it when girls are like really kinky and angry on me. I don't know. Something weird about it.
You're a sub, are you? You're a sub, but fair enough. I'm a dominant, but anyway, that doesn't matter. But, you know, whatever floats your boat, as long as everybody is of legal age, that's my thing.
Well, okay, moving on. Ghost of Shell.
Ghost of Shell. We got distracted by, you know, all this sex talk.
Well, I think Ghost in the Shell is interesting as a franchise after the movie. I mean, there was a second one that came out in 2004, which was by the same director, and it was also very well praised. And as well as you might see the standalone complex anime being made, play the English dubs on Adult Swim. And it definitely has a very interesting franchise to it. But the I think there was this, I really do believe, and there's another criticism, that the first Ghost in the Shell 1995 was very overrated. I think it's a very early, late Gen X, early millennial thing. And it seems to me that if you were into VHS culture and you had that, you showed it to your friends, it's like, oh, this isn't Don Bluth or Walt Disney. This is, ooh, it's anime. And it's less you show your friends it. And it's
the one, Ghost in the Shell. I remember there's a company down under called Madman Films, yes, that specializes in anime and has a lot of interesting titles. But I think Ghost in the Shell was the actual title that launched them, that was a kind of hit for them, and it made them a lot of money. And I do a lot of people trying, you know, basically saying, Richard, you've got to see Ghost in the Shell, the anime, you know, the Japanese anime. And I don't know. I just managed to avoid it for 20 years. And I shouldn't have. Now, I watched the first 20 minutes of it this morning. It looked good. It's the kind of film I would like. I was a fan of Akira. But for whatever reason, I just have a funny reaction against animated films in general, unless they're real classics. Like, I don't know, Watership Down or I don't know, a few
Down.
Other. Like, there you go. There's a few. There are a number of others. The 1984 film, for example, the animated 1984 film, and some of the best works of Walt Disney. And, I mean, obviously I've seen all these, and I appreciate the artistry of them all, etc. But I've never been a fan of animation for some reason. I tend to shy away from it. But, you know,
I think there's a lot of great animation. It's just not talked about. And all the animation
that's praised is just overrated.
Like, I really think Ghost in the Shell 95
is really good. Anime, I think there's been, like, a handful of really great ones, like the ones we've discussed in this show. Poem of the Wind and the Trees, Kira. I think the Golden Age, even Padaliro, the Golden Age of manga was really, like, the 80s, late 70s, even into the 90s. But, Pilliter, would you say there's been a decline in the quality of anime?
Well, the ideal that it switched from meaning science fiction big tick cyborgs to now high school anime girl dramas. And if you're just a stay-at-home bumfuck Midwest millennial, that's your only reality. And now it seems that liking anime is not hardcore, digital hardcore stuff. It just means you're a fat cosplay Midwest nerd. And so what has happened is that the selection, you go on Netflix and you might come across another high school drama of some sort, but that's the word has changed. But there's also this strange hipster thing factor, like with the popularity of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. For a long time, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure was unknown in the West. Nobody cared, and yet it was one of the it was a manga with a huge longevity and an interesting art style. I even knew it at a young age, but didn't care about it. And now
it's kind of that whole concept of like nerd chic, like things that were considered nerdy in the past have been kind of adopted by hipsters in a sense of, like, cultural
appropriation. Basically, white hipsters basically said it was authentic, and a few years ago, it got big.
That's where it came from, I think, you know, this kind of nerd culture. Again, nerd culture is a definite kind of, you know, white European thing. You know, these kind of the young kids who kind of started the whole internet and Silicon Valley and all this stuff. I mean, these are all young white nerds originally, at least even Bill Gates and bloody Steve Jobs and Zuckerberg and all these characters.
And they all married Asian too, by the way.
There you go. You know, this is like we're seeing some kind of connection here. And, you know, I think there's, you know, it's interesting that I remember actually how I first heard about a lot of this kind of Japanese stuff was through two DJs at the Hellfire Club, Ollie Olsen and Andrew Till. They were both really into Japanese kind of like electronic music and things like this that was pretty obscure. And they also loved all this animated stuff. And sometimes they would even bring along a VHS tape or an early DVD and they would let me play it at the club or so, you know. So I had seen some of the images from Ghost in the Shell because it was a fairly influential one. And, you know, you guys after this show, you know, please send me a list of, say, the top 5 or 10 animated Japanese things I should see, because I do realize there's a kind of gap in my knowledge of cinema, and whenever I do that...
I'm very obscure. I mean, a lot of my stuff I like is only known by the Japanese compared to the West. I mean, Western people basically say anything from Trigun to what's latest on the TV, and basically I could say Che the Brat or Aim for the Ace for another thing, which are completely unknown.
I would like to comment on the special effects in the film, especially a lot of like the holograms that they use, because I mean a lot of this computer animated graphics in films, in a lot of cases it feels kind of fake. But the scene where they go through the city and these holograms come out, I mean that part is really well done, especially the part where the koi fish are coming out at you. And these different like neon colors, and it feels very. I mean, I didn't even use the sunglasses, but it has a very three-dimensional feel to it. Richard, as a filmmaker, what are your thoughts on the special effects?
Yeah, look, I mean, it obviously, you know, I mean, so, like so many films, it is Blade Runner-esque, but of course, Blade Runner itself was, you know, obviously influenced by Neuromancer and William Gibson and stuff. But you know, I mean. I thought this was a very adult, kind of sophisticated portrayal of that kind of futuristic world. Obviously, this world has been portrayed in many science fiction films since Blade Runner, but I thought this one was particularly well done, you know, particularly in relation to those advertising things that were popping out at you. As you said, I saw it in 2D. I didn't see it in 3D. I don't like 3D, so I only see the 2D version normally. Well, I think 3D is just a stupid gimmick from fucking House of Wax, but, you know, which is true. And, you know, I mean, you know, I thought it was very well done, very sophisticated. I actually look forward to seeing the film again. I actually told my girlfriend this morning before she popped off to work. I said, listen, I'm going to take you to see Ghost in the Shell. It's great, you know, and I'm going to happily go see it again. And also the fact the way that the PC crowd are kind of poo-pooing it because, oh, it's whitewashed, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm telling
they
all my
asked
friends.
For it. Exactly. Why would you call it whitewash when you exactly asked for a Western adaptation of it, right? They're going to do the same thing that Akira in 2019. So it's I don't know. It's like, I think these movies, I do think the live action does justice. And I think it just shows you a lot of it. And it's really cool, you know?
As far as the kind of society they're portraying, like there's a theme of a dystopia, and there is a dystopian theme to it.
Yeah.
But there's kind of the theme of whether it's a dystopia or a utopia. I mean, is it a kind of society that you'd want to live in? I mean, there are certain aspects of it that are definitely visually appealing to a city you'd want to live in.
It's definitely a dystopia, and I think the whole film in general definitely critiques this kind of nightmare of technology that we're all falling into. And I think it's interesting that the original characters that, you know, where the brains were harvested were an anti-technology group. Now, that could be very much left-wing. It could be very much a kind of traditionalist, Avolian kind of right-wing group. It doesn't necessarily have to be left-wing kind of group. So, you know, I found that really interesting. And I think all these films that are being accused of whitewashing that have, like, Asian... You know, this counterbalances the fact that, you know, some of the more white things like Star Wars are now becoming more multicultural. So, you know, I think there's a counterbalance here between this kind of stuff and that, you know, these kind of films, I think we should definitely be supporting this and Akira if that's being westernized as well. And I find it all interesting. And I do think that the general message of Ghost in the Shell is anti-technology, that, you know, we do need to... And this fall into technology, you know, way before we get there, which is right now, boys. And hopefully that's what this podcast is beginning to raise the issue of, because, you know, do we really want to live in a world where we're connected via circuits? I don't want to fucking chip inside.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that, the right-wing interpretation is maybe those Japanese teens protecting a shrine were basically Luddites and they hated everything around them. Or
there you go. So that would be right-wing, exactly.
Yeah, it's open. It's kind of open for interpretation, and they kind of do that. So, anyone could have their own kind of fantasy of what that group is all about.
Sorry, Pillitor,
yeah. Pillitor, what are your thoughts on? Do you see that aesthetic as a kind of utopian model for your whole kind of like Asian Aryan project?
I see. The movie I felt was like there were some silly cyberpunks. I feel it was a very cyberpunk film. You know, sometimes it was desperate when a guy goes up to you and says, "Hey, you need an upgrade?" That's so cheesy. But then there are other parts where you see those two Asian twins with the blue bow ties just in the mise-en-scene. You might see these cute Asian parts in it. And it is a very cosplay film. It does look like a cheesy Ricky from Trailer Park Boys acting like an anime character. And, you know, you might see Garth Johansson trying her, and they do good jobs dressing up in costumes doing this. Yeah, at the same time, I do, dystopia aside, if the society was more healthy and more homogeneic, Eurasian or white or Asian, and have shaking hands and keeping the streets safe from bad, you know, criminal activity, or at least, you know, this nicey a free market thing, maybe you could see this Asian Aryan thing pop up. But this film, when somebody says, "Cool, I wish I was a cop shooting up places and going on," they're just flirting with this ideal they want to be in an Asian Aryan society. And a lot of it showed that in the film. So it is definitely another way of not whitewashing. You could say it's Asian Aryanizing, and maybe that's what really I'm trying, you know, I'm against that whole whitewashing thing because they're afraid to admit their Asian Aryan future, because that's what whites want too. They want these whites that want to be Asian Aryans. And so the whitewashers are scared of Asian Aryanism.
Yeah, you did touch on that criminal underground. And one thing that's interesting is the society betrayed. It is like this kind of police state, like a corporate controlled police state. But then there's this area called like the Lawless Zone, where all the criminals are free to do what they want.
Yes. Well, you know, I think these kind of worlds that are being portrayed, you know, I mean, look, and I guess this is the kind of societies we are heading into. I mean, we have to accept that within the West and even within Asia, I mean, there are different races in the West, and there are different races within Asian society. So, I mean, most majors have at least a limited multiculturalism. My attitude is that we should keep it at a limited multiculturalism, and that the West should essentially be European, and that Asian societies should essentially be, you know, pro-Asian. Whether it be Japan, it should be mainly Japanese. Whether it be China or Hong Kong, it should be mainly Chinese. And I see no problem with that. You know, with these, even with Africa. I mean, Africa should be essentially African. You know, occasionally there should be a few white people or even Asian people helping out, maybe help build the local industries, which obviously is what they need there. I don't see any problem with this kind of thing. But I do believe that certain cultures, you know, the hegemony of a certain ethnicity should remain, you know, Asian [S2] Exactly. [S1] Within Asian culture, European within European Western cultures, and, you know, African, for example, within African, and obviously Arab within Middle Eastern countries, for [S2] Yep. [S1] Fuck's sake. So, you know, there [S2]
Yeah, [S1]
It is. You [S2]
Absolutely. [S1]
Know, not even that fucking controversial. Everybody would basically agree with that. You know,
yeah, it's basic common sense.
But when you have these mixing of people, and when people are dumbfounded, they're going to accidentally create new nationalism, and hopefully there'd be that bridge of Asian Aryanism, while you could still have a complete white nationalist and Asian nationalist ethnic base. And that's basically what's happening. Exactly. So you can have nationalism for everybody.
Pillitor, you were saying, I mean, I think it's more, the film is more cyberpunk, but the one thing that was vaporwave is those interiors where the scene where the geisha robots come in.
Fantastic. The geisha robots I thought were very well done, and I was very impressed. They're not kind of spooky the way they turn into these spider-like creatures and run up the wall. I remember that thinking that's kind of effective, and I hadn't really seen that before.
Yeah.
That aesthetic even reminds me of parts of Schrader's Mishima, Life in Four Chapters. Have you seen that,
Well,
Richard?
They're in this.
Huge fan of Paul Schrader's Mishima. It's one of my favorite films of all time, and I agree. I noted some of that, and I love the stylistics of that film. Did we manage to get Paul Schrader on this show? Not yet. We're still working on it.
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't think.
No.
Not yet. We'll still.
But I do love, especially like the dream sequences in that film, Mishima. Chapters.
I love it. Fantastic stuff. Yep. So it's really good. So if we come to a kind of conclusion on this, I could tell Pilita did not like it as much as I did. And where do you stand, Robert? What would you give it out of 10, Ghost in the Shell?
I would, from a 1 to 10, From an aesthetic standpoint and cinematography standpoint, I'd give it like at least a 9, maybe almost a 10. Mm-hmm. Overall, I'd give it maybe like a 7.5. I mean, it's not the greatest film of all time, but compared to all the other films that are out this year, I'd say it's probably one of the best films that's out year or recently.
I would say something on like, I would say 6 out of 10, but this movie is going to be really remembered in a decade when it's 2018, and we're going to look at those movies from the teens years and be like, oh, look at this late teen action flick called Ghost in the Shell. It has this weird 70s...
Well, it is
70s...
interesting how each decade, how each era kind of envisions the future. Because, I mean, how they portray the future, and I know that like there's going to be another Blade Runner film coming out. I think it's going to be this year.
Ryan Gosling is in it.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how they'll do with that, capture that aesthetic.
It reminds me of like one of those like pulpy 70s films, you know. There's going to be like these pulpy films in the teen years, and I hope Ghost in the Shell, I'm looking at the Ghost in the Shell movie poster and I get some weird pulp vibes from it, where I feel like, oh yeah, this is something that's going to be remembered in 10 or 20 years as being like a action flick of the time, you know, like its own Terminator.
Yeah, look, I think like the new Depeche Mode album, it's open to interpretation, this film, but I do think that it has a lot of interesting things that will be attractive to people on the alt-right. I think the way that a lot of the main cast has been turned into Europeans, I think there's nothing for us to complain about. And, you know, I highly recommend it. So, you know, I think that sums it up for me. What do you think, boys?
Yeah, I think this was a great
show.
It's
definitely something to see. I would suggest going seeing the film
I would suggest it. Yeah.
So you can tell your friends you've seen
Sleep ahead. Turn it into a sleeper hit, because it will annoy the social justice warriors who've been writing these articles at The Guardian going, oh, how is whitewashing of Ghost in the Shell made
it? It's so annoying because they asked for it. And it's like now you're biting the hand that feeds you.
They're clucking the film's failure because they see it as whitewashing. So fuck them. Let's all go see it and turn it into a sleeper hit. That's it, boys. All right. I'm going to sign off. You happy?
Yeah, thanks, Richard, and Wollstonecraft, and thanks, Pillater. And Richard, we'll have to have you on the show when your Second Coming Volume 2 comes out.
Absolutely. I'm finishing it up at the moment. I'm quite proud of it. It's turned out rather well. It stars Jim Goad in the first 20 minutes in his first feature film appearance, and and a whole host of other people like Michael Powell and Kristen Condon and Terry McMahon and, I won't go into the whole cast, but yeah, we'll talk about it when it's out in about 6 weeks when I finished it, you know, so we'll have a chat. All right, boys, great chatting to you two as usual, Pilito and Robert. It's great, and you're a very interesting two people to be interlocutors with me this morning in Australia. So thanks a lot, boys.
Nice talking to you.
See you guys.